Hey there, welcome to another episode of the Liberators Network podcast. I'm Christian Verwijs, and in this episode, I'm going to share 10 practical things you can do to kickstart a great Scrum team. So this is an excellent episode if you're going to start a new Scrum team, obviously, but also if you have a Scrum team that's been going on for a while, but may need some refreshing in this area. But before diving into this episode, we want to thank and welcome 3 new patrons to our community. Ian Caruthers, Yuri Zaryinanov, and Johan Pei. Thank you for your support and for becoming patrons. Thanks to patrons, it's easy for Barry and me to create more free content like this. Free podcasts, blog posts, free meetups, tools like Team Metrics and the Zombie Scrum Survey, but also all the other things that we make available for free. Honestly, we'd like to spend 100% of our time doing that. But we also have mortgages and bills to pay. So by donating or supporting our show by becoming a patron, you can help Barry and me find more time to do this. So if you think it's valuable to yourself and to the community, please consider supporting us. I'll put some options for donations in the show notes so you can see what's useful to you. But let's move on to the episode. In this episode, we would like to share our experiences on how to best kickstart, lift off, or launch a new Scrum team. Over the years, and many, many teams later, we've learned that a good start makes half the work. Sending people to a Scrum training, putting them together as a new Scrum team, and expecting general awesomeness to follow is just unrealistic. Scrum is all about self-organizing teams that frequently deliver working software. Just putting people together and calling them a team is not going to make them a team nor self-organizing. Teamwork is about collaboration, it's about psychological safety, it's about playing on each other's strengths and knowing what they are. That's why we've learned to spend a lot of time on team building activities when we help new Scrum teams. Understand team development and your role in it. In order to kickstart a new team, it helps to understand how they develop. And the Tuckman Stages of Group Development is a useful model in this regard. It was developed in 1965 by the psychologist Bruce Tuckman, and it describes the phases that most teams progress through in order to become an actual team. Tuckman built his model on 26 studies on how small groups develop, and he identified 5 distinct phases in their progression. The first phase is the forming phase. In this phase, the team is mostly concerned with their reason for being. Why are they together? What's the purpose of the team? What tasks is the team supposed to pick up? In this phase, people are usually not familiar with each other yet. The sense of safety that comes with familiarity is still missing, meaning that criticism, irritations, doubt, and uncertainties are not yet openly voiced. Instead, people tend to focus on the task at hand and what is expected of them. In this phase, people don't generally feel part of the team yet. And during this phase, the best role for the Scrum Master is to take that of the teacher. Make sure that people know what to do and provide clarity on purpose and initial structure. The second phase is the storming phase. When people become familiar with each other and safety starts to build, they also become more willing to voice doubts, worries, and frustration. The first conflicts tend to emerge in this phase. Initially, they will focus primarily on tasks. Who will do what, who will do this, but not on each other yet. But as familiarity increases, small irritations between members, which includes you, will surface. And this is a natural result of differences between what members expect from themselves, from each other, and from the team. Be mindful that conflicts can be active and visible, in that people are actually voicing them, or passive, in that they're resisting it or withdrawing from the process. Although this is not always a fun phase to be in, it is a critical phase in the development of a team. If sufficient opportunity is given to constructively resolve conflicts, the team will learn to trust each other. Trying to shortcut this phase by covering up conflicts or ignoring them altogether is really the worst thing you can do. The best role for the Scrum Master is that of a coach. Don't resolve the conflicts for the team, but help them identify conflicts and navigate them on their own. The third phase is the norming phase. When the conflicts that emerge during the storming phase can be dealt with in a constructive and safe manner, the team moves into a norming phase. The focus of this phase is to find a balance between what members expect from each other and from the team. This has to do with aspects of work, like quality, speed, thoroughness, perfectionism, but also how people behave, the social norms that guide how the team works. In other words, the team is agreeing on the norms, values, and rules that govern their work as a team. During the norming phase, discussions become more task-oriented. This is much like what happens in the first phase, but in a way that is more mindful of the norms that the team has established. This is the phase where people start to truly feel part of and become loyal to the team. The best role to take as a Scrum Master is that of a mentor. Using the Scrum framework and your knowledge of Agile software development, you can help the team to work out a productive mode of working together. The fourth phase is the performing phase. Now that there is safety in the team, and there is a shared sense of what's important and what is not, and when the team has established rules for working together, they can start working together constructively. In this phase, people become more flexible in their role and what it is that they do. This is the phase where self-organization becomes most evident. A team member that stands in for an unavailable Scrum Master or developers that pick up tasks that are outside of their direct comfort zone. The fear of failing and making mistakes has mostly dissolved. Although task-oriented discussions are and will remain common, the general atmosphere within the team is positive and constructive. The best role for the Scrum Master is that of advisor. The team is perfectly capable of solving most problems on their own, but help them find the best solutions when they run into problems they can't fix on their own, or impediments as we call them. And finally, there is the fifth phase, the adjourning phase. All teams eventually dissolve. Perhaps the purpose has been achieved, or the team is disbanded for other reasons. Especially for long-running teams, or teams that have worked together intensely for a short period, this can be quite a traumatic and impactful experience. In this phase, it is important to use rituals and events to say goodbye to the team and to each other. The best role for the Scrum Master is that of facilitator. Provide opportunities for people to express emotions that are associated with departures and help them make sense of it. According to Tuckman's model, all teams progress through these five phases. Some do it faster, some do it slower. Some teams get stuck in a particular phase, usually the storming or the norming phase, when key conflicts remain unresolved. Changes in team composition, even if it's just a single person, generally regress a team back to the norming phase. A powerful reason not to mess with team composition too often, isn't it? How much time a team needs to progress through the stages greatly depends on team composition and external factors. But it certainly isn't a matter of hours or even days. My personal experience is that teams need at least 3 or 4 sprints to arrive at the norming phase and a couple more to arrive at the performing phase. Now, I should mention that there is fairly limited empirical evidence for the Tuckman model. If you research how teams develop, the stages are generally not as clear-cut and discrete as the model suggests, and neither is the linear path that teams go through the phases. Still, I think the Tuckman model helps in the sense that it emphasizes how important time is. You cannot rush the development of a team. If you put a group of people together, they're not a team automatically. They need to figure out how to work together, and this takes time. And I think that having the Tuckman model in mind is very helpful when you start a new Scrum team, because it helps you understand what's going on and what the team needs from you to proceed. It also emphasizes that you can't rush teams through the phases, what it often actually happens in organizations. Instead, it tells you to be observant and attentive to what's happening in a team during Scrum events and outside of them. You will notice when a team is ready or moving forward into a new stage as the nature of their discussions and conflicts change. Next, we'll offer 10 helpful tips that we have found to be useful to support teams in this development. The first tip is to reserve time for the kickstart. A kickstart is not something you should do in the final 2 hours on a Friday afternoon as an afterthought. It is a moment where the foundation of a team is being laid, and we tend to reserve 2 or even 3 days for a kickstart, sometimes even longer. The first day we mostly spend on Scrum training to refresh the principles of Scrum, more on that later on, and how to best apply Scrum within the context of the team. The second day is spent on team building, and we usually play a variety of games to get to know each other and to help the team create safety and familiarity with each other. The second part of the second day is focused on setting up a team manifest. This helps to trigger the kind of discussions and conversations that are part of the storming phase. And the third day is usually spent on setting up a product backlog and starting the first sprint. Spending 3 days on a kickstart is intense and a serious investment. But it does send an important signal to the team. We are serious about this and we're taking time to become a team. Without exception, teams that spend this amount of time on starting up have a much smoother ride down the road and move to the performing phase much more rapidly. The second tip is that getting to know each other is half the work. It doesn't matter if people are entirely new to each other or if they've already worked with each other for a long time. So spend some time during the first sessions as a team to get to know each other. Sometimes we ask people to introduce themselves as the superhero they'd like to be, or to visualize their strengths with Lego bricks, or to create a personal profile card and avatar. This works well independent of how people know each other. The key here is to break the ice and to get people out of their comfort zones and out of the usual conversations. It also helps people feel less restrained during the remainder of the sessions. Make sure to facilitate these exercises in a light-hearted, fun way, so as to make it non-threatening for people to participate. It's perfectly fine if these exercises feel a bit awkward. It's better to cut through the awkwardness now than having people feel restrained to participate later on. The third tip is to teach Scrum. A Scrum team should not have only two members that have actually read a book on Scrum or participated in a course, while the rest doesn't have a clue. Scrum is so popular these days that people often have very different interpretations and misconceptions about what Scrum is and what it isn't. That is why we always start with a Scrum training when we help start new Scrum teams. For teams that are entirely new to Scrum, the training is more thorough, but we always spend at least a few hours on it, even for experienced teams. Teams believe that they know exactly how Scrum works can prepare a pitch and explain Scrum to us. For all intents and purposes, this training is highly interactive. So we play games, go through a variety of exercises and cases, and use liberating structures to trigger discussions and conversations. So we don't sidestep disagreement, criticism, or doubts during this phase, because that's bound to damage trust and openness in the team. If people disagree about Scrum, or they don't like it, or they are skeptical of it, then it's okay to raise those concerns, and we take them seriously. Voicing disagreements is a sign that people care and feel involved. We'd be worried when teams don't actually voice their criticism or disagreement because it shows that they don't care enough. To trigger some productive conflict, we often use a shift and share with open-ended questions like, what is appealing about Scrum to you? What puts you off? Or, how can we make Scrum work for us? Or, what risks and opportunities does Scrum present for you? These questions are designed to trigger conversations and discussions and to voice disagreements. We take all criticism seriously and respond to them as best as we can, or we invite people in the team to respond to them instead. The fourth tip is to formulate a team vision. You can help a team move through the norming phase by having them think about what it means to be a good team. One exercise that works really well is to have teams imagine the worst possible team and the best possible team. Based on a number of characteristics like communication, leadership, and quality, we let people pair up and brainstorm typical behaviors and things you're likely to hear when working with these teams. The pairs then present their findings, and we discuss what this means as a team. Not only is this a fun exercise to do, it also helps teams become aware of productive and unproductive behaviors. It helps them think about what it means to be a good team, how people work together in these teams, and what kind of behavior you'll see in case of conflicts and stressful periods. Basically, the team creates a vision of what it means to be a good team, but also the opposite. An alternative exercise is to have the team formulate a team manifest. Barry Overeem has written a nice post on how to do this. Our experience is that this works best with teams that are already comfortable with each other to express disagreement. If that safety isn't present yet, which is often the case with new teams, the manifest will just contain a lot of open doors or platitudes, like a politically correct team manifesto. But it will not describe how people really feel. Therefore, this exercise is better reserved for when teams actually hit the norming phase. It is then that creating a manifesto has the most value. The fifth tip is to create a team contract. When you begin with Scrum, it is helpful to create clarity. How are we going to work as a team? Who is responsible for what? When are the Scrum events? Clarity in roles and tasks is important for teams that are in the very early stages of formation. Because the team does not yet offer a perfectly safe environment, members need to know what is expected of them. That is why we often help teams formulate a team contract during their kickstart. Using a couple of prepared sheets, we ask the team, with our help, to agree on a set of working agreements. The first question we ask is, who are actually the members of this team? What do they bring? What do they add? What skills do they have? The second question is, how are roles distributed? Who is the Scrum Master? Who is the Product Owner? Who's part of the development team? People that are not on the sheet are not part of the Scrum team, and do not participate during the various Scrum events unless they're invited. When and where are the various Scrum events is another question. Who is expected to be there? The fourth question is, what happens when someone's late for a Scrum event or unable to join altogether? How do we communicate this? And finally, we ask the team to clarify what makes them happy or what would make them happy with a sprint when they look back on it. So what criteria should be met for us to be happy with our success as a team? During the exercise, we generally move to the back of the room and let the team fill in the sheets together. This is an excellent way to observe team dynamics and get a sense of the phase that a team is in. When the sheets are done, we take them to the team rooms and make sure they're visible to all. An example of a team contract sheet is in the show notes. Tip number 6 is to pick a team name. During the norming phase, teams start developing a group identity. This identity consists of the norms, the values, and the principles on how people want to work together. A very simple but powerful exercise is to have teams come up with a name for their team during the kickstart. So we usually ask pairs to come up with as many good names as they can think of, and then let them dot vote on the best name together. Although picking a name is always useful to promote a team identity, it works even better when there are other teams close to the team's proximity. Teams start taking pride in their name. The naming exercise taps into something called mere group membership, a phenomenon observed by social and organizational psychologists. People more easily associate themselves with a group if you give them something small to identify with, especially when there are other groups nearby. I once coached two teams who picked the names A-Team and Team B, respectively. Not highly original, but it didn't take long for fancy posters with the team names to appear in the rooms of the teams. Team B then decided to decorate the poster of the A team with the addendum "from A to B" with "better" in parentheses behind it. Another team I coached picked the name Rubber Duckies after multiple rounds of heated dot voting because not everyone agreed with the name. But a few sprints later, the team got an actual rubber duck for their team room and they became really proud of the name. These are just some small examples of the power of picking a name for your team. A fun exercise that I often do as an extension of picking a name is to have teams create a team poster to pitch their team to potential new members. Teams decorate the poster with quotes, imagery, and slogans that exemplify their team. We provide the team with magazines, newspapers, lots of paper, pencils, and glue, and let them go at it. It's a great way to end the team building that is part of the kickstart, usually the second day. And it's a good way to end on a high note while making them think about what makes them a great team to be a part of. The posters tend to end up in the team rooms, and needless to say, we always have a lot of fun with this exercise. Tip number 7 is to set expectations. A good Scrum team does not form within one or two sprints. It takes time to learn how to best work together. Except for a good kickstart, there is no way to speed up team formation through artificial means. So make sure to manage the expectations of the team and the people around them, so that the initial motivation does not drop when the reality hits that it doesn't go as fast as they want to. The first few sprints are generally quite tough. When teams start, they begin in the forming phase. This means that they are task-oriented and usually quite optimistic. The kind of psychological safety to express doubts and worries is not yet there, which often leads to artificial optimism. During the first sprints, this safety will start to form as people work together more closely, so conflicts, irritations, and frustrations will start to surface. This is only natural, as people get to know each other better and start getting annoyed by things, and the difficulties of development hit the team. Once teams move into the norming phase, more time will be needed to help the team formulate norms, principles, and values. It is only when a team hits the performing phase that they can actually be fully productive. This is usually 3 to 5 two-week sprints down the road, sometimes even more. Tip number 8 is retrospectives, retrospectives, and retrospectives again. The sprint retrospective is sometimes seen as a good opportunity for people to complain about things that are not working. But this is not a productive, helpful use of this important Scrum event. Instead, the sprint retrospective is the Scrum event where a team can grow. So don't skip them. Prepare them well and try different approaches. What really applies here is the quote, "If you always do what you've always done, you will always get what you've always got." Different formats for sprint retrospectives help new teams reflect on themselves and their process through different lenses. With new teams, we often start simple, with a plus delta format. So we ask members to write down at least 2 pluses, things that went well, and 2 deltas, things that can be improved. They first do this individually and in silence, and then we let people pair up to build on their ideas and then share it with the whole group. Depending on the number and the grouping, we either discuss all individual pluses and deltas, or we dot vote on the ones that we want to discuss in more detail. At the end, we distill 2 or 3 concrete improvement actions from this format for the team to work on during the next sprint. We bring along the 2 or 3 improvements during the next sprint retrospective to see how things went. As the team progresses, you can use other formats like the Agile Speedboat, the Retrospective Radar, or many of the other formats that are available on the Agile Retrospective Wiki. I'll put the link in the show notes. Sprint retrospectives are also an excellent opportunity to use a variety of liberating structures, like TRIZ, Appreciative Interviews, One, Two, For All, and What, So What, Now What, but the possibilities are really endless. Tip number 9 is to involve management to support the kickstart. A Scrum team will be dealing with a lot of complexity, both internally and externally. When you kickstart a new Scrum team, it helps to ask management to come and show their support for the process. This can be done at the start of the kickoff, or at the end, or even throughout. A key message that I always give is that support is not a one-way street. Telling a team that you support them is not the same as actively listening to them, actively asking them what they need from you. Also, you need to make sure that the people who come show support know what Scrum is and what's going to happen. Otherwise, you risk conflicting messages. We once had a manager that took the stage to state in no uncertain terms that from now on, we'll start working in a way that always hits budgets and deadlines. And good luck with your kickstart. As you can imagine, that was not the best way to start. And the final tip is to bring it to the team. The final tip may be the most important one. As we mentioned in the introduction, Scrum teams are self-organizing units that deliver working software. Self-organization is fairly abstract and vague. But what it boils down to is that a team becomes increasingly capable to solve problems on their own. The role of the Scrum Master, or the Agile Coach for that matter, is not to solve the problem for a team, but to help them solve the problem on their own. Every problem presents the opportunity for a team to grow in their ability to do so. This is why the principle of bringing it to the team is so important. Instead of organizing work for the team or solving problems for them, let the team come up with the solutions on their own. The value of a good coach and a good Scrum Master is that he or she is capable to ask the kinds of questions that are needed to help teams understand what the problem actually is and to identify workable solutions. A simple example of this principle is something I experienced a few years ago. I facilitated an agile transition with 5 Scrum teams. Management really wanted to start with continuous delivery and was eager to appoint one person to take responsibility for researching what potential this held for the company. This is a common and quite frankly understandable strategy in more traditionally oriented organizations. People are made responsible for a problem by giving them a hat, like the quality code hat or the continuous delivery hat. This runs counter to self-organization though, so we suggested an alternative approach and asked the teams to come up with the best way to explore continuous delivery on their own. The teams then decided to organize several workshops on the topic, with each team sending 1 or 2 members as representatives. The workshops resulted in input for the shared product backlog and, most importantly, shared learning. This particular approach was then adopted for other concerns like increasing code quality and automated testing. A good example of bringing it to the teams. Let's move to some closing thoughts. Kickstarting a new Scrum team is no small affair. Although there is certainly an investment in time and money involved, a good kickstart will help a Scrum team become awesome more quickly. In this post, we offer 10 practical tips on how to best facilitate such a Scrum kickstart. This is based on our own experience, so we're very interested to hear your own thoughts and tips on how you kickstarted Scrum teams. Let us know in the comments. And this brings us to the end of the episode. We hope you learned something new about how to kickstart new Scrum teams and, more importantly, how important a good start is to the success of a Scrum team. If you liked the episode, please rate it, give it a thumbs up or review it on whatever platform you're listening on, and maybe recommend it to friends that may be interested in it. If you like it, please also consider donating to support us in making more of this free content available. Other than that, we want to thank you for listening. Have a great day and see you next time!